of the February calendar. It's 99-1013, Credit Services of North Central Wisconsin versus David Wasaki. I've got a schedule here that shows Attorney Slater argues for 15 minutes on behalf of Farm Credit Services. Attorney Rumbaugh argues for the Wisconsin Manufacturers, 10 minutes for as amicus. And Mr. Dreyer has 30 minutes representing Mr. Wasaki. You get 5 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Slater. Is that correct? Okay. Then you may start.
Thank you, and may it please the court. This morning, listening to arguments, we heard people say that let's get to the chase or keep our eye on the ball. And I think the ball here is the basic fact that this is a contract case. It's a contract case at a couple of different levels that should be addressed by this court. The first contract level is whether or not Mr. Wysocki indeed contracted with the plaintiff in this case, which is known as Farm Credit Services of North Central Wisconsin. And in order to determine that, you have to look through a series of mergers which occurred between Production Credit Association of Wausau, which is the contractual named organization with whom Mr. Wysocki contracted, and Mr. Wysocki, and what happened to that corporation through the mergers. And in the record, in this case, is an affidavit by the general counsel of Agribank, which is the bank which funds farm credit under the farm credit system, the intermediate bank, and which supervises, in some respects, farm credit's operations. And the merger documents between, in the first case, other production credit associations, which were asset-based lenders, short-term working capital type lenders. And in the second case, the 1991 merger, the Federal Land Bank, which was a real estate-based lender, when those merged following the amendment to the Farm Credit Act in 1987. We believe that an examination of those documents shows the intent and shows clearly that it's a statutory merger. Now, Farm Credit Services is not a Wisconsin corporation. So if you go and you look in the Department of Financial Institutions, you won't see corporate documents filed on behalf of it, nor on behalf of the other PCAs, with some minor exceptions. The Farm Credit Act permits associations organized under it to merge. And it says what they have to do to merge and what the result will be, but it does not lay out the in the way the state statute does, the effect of merger. The state statute, we believe, when it comes to interpreting state law and the effect of mergers on contracts within the state or on the transfer of assets, that statute, those two statutes, 180.67 and 180.1106, which the trial court relied on for both the mergers, we believe that they do in fact apply to farm credit in the in its operations on a day-to-day basis. In this case, the defense has relied in its attack on the contract issue on two documents. One is an affidavit of merger which was filed in 1986, and the other is a copy of the original articles of the PCA of Wausau which has the term, the word canceled on it. Neither of those documents are merger documents. Neither of those documents have succumbed to the scrutiny of examination. Do you have a question?
No.
Oh,
Mr. Slater, I
yes.
have a question, though. The Court of Appeals in this case didn't decide the issue in terms of whether or not this was the same corporation.
Correct.
But rather assumed arguendo that it was.
That's correct.
Now, I remember as a trial judge that I used to use that sometimes in situations where there really were some genuine issues of material fact. And I'm wondering if you don't have a situation here where there are genuine issues of material fact as to whether this is the same corporation. What's your position in that regard?
Whether it's the same corporation is going to depend on the merger documents and what the intent of those documents is and what happened to PCA. I don't believe that the pleadings say it's not the same entity, all right? So that draws the merger documents into question. The merger documents are attached to an affidavit. There has been no testimony as to the intent of the parties with respect to what they were going to do. The record as it stands has our allegation that it's the same. It has a denial that it's the same. It has a bunch of documents which show what happened. It's sort of like an abstract of a corporation, if you would. And to the extent that that may raise a question, yes, there would be. There are affidavits by participants as to what the intent was, and I don't believe there are any affidavits addressed to that issue on record. There are affidavits as to whether or not the contract, the covenant contract, was enforced, but I don't believe there are any affidavits which have raised questions as to the merger. So there would be a question in my mind as to whether using the summary judgment methodology, which requires that affidavits be answered with affidavits, was carried by the defendant, because we put affidavits in which said, here it is, here's the abstract of this corporation, and this shows it. And no affidavits were
given. Is there not an argument that's made from the documents, that the documents themselves have some inconsistencies in them in regard to whether this is indeed the same corporation?
The only document placed which show an inconsistency are two. One is the affidavit which was filed, the affidavit of merger. And in preparing for today, I reread that document, and to my great embarrassment, that document is wrong. But it's not one of the merger. What it states is not factually correct. Further embarrassment, one of my partners drafted it. But it's not factually correct, and it's put of record so that the title companies will be able to determine when Farm Credit has to go in and foreclose a mortgage or something like that. The title companies want to be able to see any changes which have occurred in name, et cetera. And because Farm Credit is not a Wisconsin corporation, we put the affidavit of merger on, stating what happened, though stating incorrectly. So name-wise, they can see that this is a successor for writing title. But it's not part of the merger document.
All right. Well, bear with me for just a minute. Let's assume that this is not the same corporation, or at least that that issue is very much open on the summary judgment situation. Is there not then an issue in regard to assignment, and is there not also an issue in regard to consent by the employee for either amendment of the contract or for assignment?
There is no assignment provision in the contract. Under Wisconsin law, I think under both Hunter and Wisconsin Medical, Wausau Medical, you say you not only look at a contract in this area at its inception, but you also look at performance as you go along. And the trial court did not do that, and no evidence was taken. So, yes, there would be or should be an issue of fact as to whether or not from 1986, when the first merger occurred, Mr. Wysocki remained an employee. He took salary. He was aware of what was going on. There could be an issue and should be an issue of fact as to whether or not the parties orally agreed with offer acceptance consideration that the limitation on his post-employment activities would continue.
Just your answer to Justice Crooks's question was that you do believe, and I think that was the one of the issues in the dissent in the Court of Appeals, that there were and still are material issues of fact.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. And I think the covenant cases and I think just contract law it tells you what you have to do, and you've got to look at the facts, you've got to look at the intent of the parties, and none of that was examined at the lower court level, and it was just assumed by the Court of Appeals as it as
usually a written instrument. A written instrument can be read by the court and interpreted. It doesn't. That's a question of law, what that instrument means.
Correct.
Whether these documents amount to that A corporation is merged with B and they're one and the same is a question of law that court is going to look at from the documents, not take testimony on them.
Only if it's ambiguous in some respect. The defendant has called into question whether or not the parties are the same contractual parties. We've said they are. We've put into evidence by affidavit, not by testimony, the documents which go to prove that.
That's right. And not testimony describing the documents otherwise, or saying, well, I was there and I drafted it and this is what we said to each other.
Right, but the lower court did not say, all right, under this merger document. The lower court went off on another tangent.
I understand that, but I'm trying to see if there's really any factual issue when you've got written documents. And then I'm trying to explore whether there's a factual issue on whether or not employment contracts like this are automatically assigned. When a new entity takes over, if it is a merger, and all of, at least under Wisconsin law, and I know we have a federal issue here, the corporation just takes everything, contracts, et cetera.
That's our position.
I understand that, but that's a matter of law. It's not a matter of facts here. I mean, we don't have to. If it's a matter of law that the contract is employment is assigned, we don't have to ask whether the employee agreed to assign it.
That's correct.
And we don't have to ask whether there was a consent.
That's correct. Not in a statutory merger.
That's right. So I'm just trying to explore whether or not there is a material issue, an issue of material fact that needs summary judgment. But I gather your part of the argument relates to the corporate, and that Mr. Rumbaugh is going to talk about the restrictive covenant. Is that right?
I'm prepared to talk in part about it. Mr. Rumbaugh is going to talk exclusively about it.
Okay. Well, let's just talk about it for a moment, if we can. Here you have a corporation that was operating in 5.5 states. It's then widely increased in scope of business.
Well, I understand. Was this 5.5 counties or 5.5 states?
5.5 counties.
Counties.
Did I say states?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I meant counties. Would this contract, by the words of the contract, it covers, it's not limited to any number of states.
The contract does not, excuse me, the contract does not speak in terms of any geographic area whatsoever.
Whatever the corporation does business.
Yes, wherever the corporation does business, it speaks strictly in terms of customers.
Reduced to two counties, that's where he would have been restricted.
Wherever the customers were drawn from, if they had authority to draw and go up to Upper Michigan, or if the Farm Credit Administration were to eliminate the geographic charter restrictions, wherever. The contract is silent as to it, and that's where we pick up from what the dissent says, is that they have gone and amended and annealed or welded an outside provision into this contract, which was not contemplated, or we don't think was contemplated by the parties. There's no finding that we have an ambiguous contract that needs interpretation, which would go first, and then you might find what the parties meant by it, but yet the courts, both lower courts, seem to say that there's some ambiguity here. Without taking testimony, it goes and it says, well, there's been a unilateral amendment, and we think that's wrong, and that does not comply. Again, it's a contract case, and how do you amend a contract?
Well, this could have been all the counties in the state, and then he could not have, under the restrictive covenant, contacted any of these clients for whom he worked anywhere in the state, which would, in effect, at least for a year, put him out of business in this state.
Not true.
Okay. Why not?
Because it only was contacting people whose tax returns he prepared in the 1 year prior to his termination. So he could have set up an office right next to Farm Credit, put tax preparation on it, bookkeeping, and he could have even solicited and prepared tax returns for Farm Credit Services customers whom he did not prepare returns for in the prior year, plus everybody else in the state of Wisconsin. So there's a very, very limited number of people whom he was prohibited from servicing for 1 year following his termination. And it's only people whose tax returns he prepared in the prior year.
Okay, that was it. So anyone in the new corporation that he had not seen or had done anything for, he was free to work for, correct? We're only talking about the people that he had dealt with.
That's correct. Only people he dealt with.
Thank you, Mr. Slater. You will have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Eric Rumbaugh. I'm here on behalf of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. I want to pick up on what Chief Justice Abrahamson just asked about, which is the narrowness of the scope of the non-competition agreement. We in the bar have heard this court. We in the bar around the country have heard the Supreme Courts of the other states. This court has asked for non-competition agreements to be as narrowly drafted as possible. In Hunter, this court said, limitation expressed in terms of particular clients or customers more closely approximates the area of an employer's vulnerability to unfair competition by a former employee and does not deprive the employee of legitimate competitive opportunities to which he's entitled. If you have a customer-based restriction and an employee who just does work in Waukesha County and he has 20 customers in Waukesha County, he's had contact with them the last year, and he leaves, for the next year he can call on the 500 entities that might buy widgets from him that he didn't call on in the preceding year. This court has said that's narrower, where the interest that sought to be protected is customer contact. We prefer that. Now, in Hunter, the non-competition agreement this court approved, or held wasn't facially invalid, went beyond customer contact. It went to 6,000 customers, many of whom the employees had no contact with. And this court refused to say that would be facially invalid. This court remanded it for determination on that issue. So there are protectable interests beyond customer contact that this court has approved. But where the interest that sought to be protected is customer contact only, this court and the courts of the other states have all said customer contact restrictions are narrower, better, we like them. We've heard that, and that's what we draft. The Court of Appeals decision in this case imperils the agreements that we've drafted because we follow what this court has said. The non-competition agreement in this case is much narrower in every way than the agreement in Hunter that this court approved. In Hunter, the agreement covered 18 months, and it covered over 6,000 customers, many of whom the employees had no contact with. In this case, the agreement is limited to customers which the employee consulted or serviced in performance of his or her consultant duties at any time during the 1 year immediately prior to the separation. So it's a shorter time frame, and it's only customers he had contact with. So it's, we in the bar would say, we did what this court wanted, what's wrong with this agreement? Now, the Court of Appeals said that there's something wrong with this agreement. And the issue is a geographic restriction appended to this contract? Now, we disagree. I admit the Court of Appeals decision is confusing. Opposing counsel and I disagree over what the Court of Appeals did. I submit, if you look at paragraphs 14, 15, and 16 of the Court of Appeals decision, what the Court of Appeals did is it pointed to some language in Chuckwagon and Van Zeeland, two earlier decisions of this court, that referred to a route-non-route distinction and said, well, Mr. Wysocki didn't have a route, and now I understand that's at issue. He may have had what this court would call a route. But the Court of Appeals assumed he didn't have a route and therefore looked beyond the four corners of the contract to the charter to find a geographic restriction. The Court of Appeals said the agreement in Chuckwagon that this court approved was valid because, and this is the Court of Appeals interpreting this court, saying this, what this court did was okay in Chuckwagon because, and I quote the Court of Appeals at paragraph 14, the geographic territory which Raduji served on the route and the route's customer list were coextensive. Stated another way, the prohibited customer list in Chuckwagon did define a geographic territory, as well as those customers within it, because it covered only those businesses on Raduji's route. So according to the Court of Appeals, there was no valid restriction in this case unless you go outside the contract and look to the charter. It didn't need to do that. Under Hunter and under Chuckwagon and under the other decisions of this court, the customer restriction in Wysocki in this case was perfectly valid. There was no need to look outside of the contract to find a geographic restriction. The Court of Appeals thought it had to, in the way I read the Court of Appeals decision, that didn't think you could have a valid customer-based restriction without a route. Now, I'm prepared to debunk the route-non-route distinction. It's in my brief. I think I've addressed it. I don't think opposing counsel and I disagree on this. As I read Roman numeral section 1 of their reply brief, they've conceded that they argue that the Court of Appeals didn't do what I'm saying it did. I read their brief as conceding that there is no route-non-route distinction. I would submit that the Van Zeeland case that the Court of Appeals relied on doesn't draw one either. Van Zeeland points back to this court's decision in Abbott, which didn't draw a bright line, and Van Zeeland didn't draw a bright line. Van Zeeland and Abbott said, if you've got a route where you're the only one who services the customers in the route, it's easier to find a protectable interest. But it didn't say you can't have a protectable interest if you don't have a route. And no decision of this court has ever said that. In Chuckwagon, this court said you can have a protectable interest if you're protecting a route or customer served. And in Hunter, this court twice in this court's decision in Hunter noted that the insurance salesman in that case, did not have a route. So this court knew that the non-competition agreement that it approved in Hunter wasn't a route agreement, but it approved it. So I would submit that there's no basis in statute or in any decision of this court to make a route-non-route distinction, and the bar hasn't done it. The agreements that have been drafted following this court's decisions in Hunter and previous cases don't have a route-non-route distinction. And opposing counsel referred to us as Chicken Little in his brief for suggesting that great damage would be done to the law by the Court of Appeals decision. I would suggest, if the Court of Appeals decision is read the way I read it, to say that there's a route-non-route distinction, it would do great damage. And if opposing counsel thinks it didn't do it and doesn't think that's an issue, then we would ask this court, whatever it does on the privity issue, to simply say in its decision, to the extent the Court of Appeals decision suggests that a customer-based restriction is only enforceable in the case of a route salesman, We find that decision to be inconsistent with this court's decision in Hunter, and we disavow it. I don't think the parties disagree on that issue, but if we do, that's what we ask the court to do. So if you don't have a route, non-route distinction as a reason for a need to look outside the contract, why are you looking outside the contract? If you look in the Court of Appeals decision and throughout opposing counsel's brief, what they want to do is make this an issue of the geographic terms in the charter. And the charter changed, so therefore you need new bargaining and new consideration. That's their syllogism. But the charter isn't the agreement. The agreement is the customers Mr. Wysocki served in the preceding year. So it shouldn't matter if they add 10 counties or 10 countries, because you have a customer-based restriction. The restriction contemplates growth, addition, subtraction of customers, just like the one that this court approved in Hunter. If you add a county, it shouldn't matter. You don't have the route, non-route distinction, so now, in opposing counsel's reply brief, the argument is you need to look outside the contract because the law is appended to all contracts. And the opposing counsel cites this court's 1916 decision in Rolfe for the proposition, I quote from Rolfe, the existing law of the land is part of every contract and must be read into it. I submit that that is a red herring. In this court, in State versus Adamany, 64 was second 280, which is a 1974 decision of this court, was confronted with this same argument. And this court rejected it. And in fact, rejected, found unconstitutional a state statute that required tax relief to landowner or to landowners to be reimbursed to tenants. This court said, it is equally simplistic to say, as apparently do the defendants, that any legislation that arguably has some public purpose will override a previously made bargain.
Counsel?
Yes. As I was reading these briefs, it struck me that there must be all kinds of law on the subject of what happens when companies merge or are taken over. I mean, companies operate under labor union contracts, they operate under employment contracts with their employees, etc. And at least as I looked at the case, it seemed to me that Mr. Wysocki was arguing that because this was a different entity that he was dealing with now than he was dealing with in 1983, that somehow the party no longer existed, and therefore he was not bound by the contract.
That's the issue that Mr. Slater is dealing with, the privity issue. I'm not addressing the privity issue. My argument is don't make employers renegotiate when you have a customer-based restriction and your customers change.
I was just going to ask you, and I should have asked Mr. Slater, but I figure you're from Foley and you know everything.
I'm from Michael Bassett.
Well, what is the law on that when companies merge or companies are taken over and they've got employment contracts or labor union contracts? Are those labor union contracts or employment contracts simply no longer valid?
The short answer, and my light went on, I still have stuff I want to cover, but I'll address the short answer is if you take over the same business and you have the same employees doing the same work, typically the labor agreement continues. Or rather, the labor relationship continues. There's a different test for whether the actual contract continues. If you, and at shorthand, if you hire most of the employees, you may be taking over the collective bargaining agreement. That's not my issue. I don't want to step on Mr. Slater's toes. That's not what we petitioned on.
Well, let me ask you a question about your issue. What would you expect this court to write? Does this have to go back on your issue for a test of reasonableness, or is this a matter of law that this court can do on this record?
Well, what Mr. Slater believes the matter has to be remanded, I defer to him. In Hunter, this court remanded because it said there was nothing facially invalid about the agreement, and remanded to determine whether the employee in Hunter actually had the employer actually had a protectable relationship. That's what the Court of Appeals did in General Medical Corporation versus Cobbs, which found a non-route, non-competition agreement broader than Mr. Wysocki's to be enforceable. So in both Cobbs and Hunter, this court and the Court of Appeals remanded. I'm fine with that. I'm sorry, Justice Sykes.
Well, usually the enforceability of these non-competes is decided by the court, the trial court, either typically sitting in an injunction hearing, right, or on cross motions for summary judgment.
It's my, yes.
Usually, that's how they're usually handled.
It's my understanding that no test...
Or a declaratory judgment, right? It's
my understanding that no testimony was taken in the record below regarding Mr. Wysocki's contacts with his customers. What this court remanded for in Hunter was, okay, there's nothing facially wrong with the agreement, let's see if you actually had enough contacts to create a protectable interest. And I'm not, I express no opinion on that. What I want, Chief Justice Abrahamson asked, what do you want this court to write? What I want this court to write is two things. One, you don't need a route to have a protectable, or rather to have an enforceable customer-based restriction. And two, if you have a customer-based restriction, if the parties have bargained for a flexible customer-based restriction, like in this case and like in Hunter, when the customers change, you don't need to renegotiate. And I would now what I was getting to. May I have permission to
very quickly? Please.
There's you only this court in State versus Adamany refused to reflexively import the law into contracts, and in fact refused to in that case. This court has repeatedly held that we're not going to rewrite what the parties have written, even if we find what the parties have found to be disadvantageous to one or the other parties. Algum versus Nolan and Levy versus Levy are two cases that I'd cite for that proposition. The case that the, under the Farm Credit Act, okay, thank you.
If I could just quickly nail down the position on the question that you asked, which is apparently you don't have a position about whether there are any facts in dispute on either the survivability of this contract after the mergers or on an ultimate question of the enforceability of this covenant. You're just interested in getting the Court of Appeals rule of law that it established reversed.
Yes, Justice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Dreyer.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Gary Dreyer. I represent David Wysocki. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. To begin with, I think we're here for two reasons. First of all, perhaps a word processing error, and second, the name of the status of the plaintiff. This contract, the employment contract, does not say it's binding on successors and assigns. To answer the question, Justice Babich's question, what usually happens if there's a merger? Well, typically in the Farm Credit Services documents I've seen, the notes and mortgages are binding on the successors and the assigns. For some reason, the employment contract in this case did not state it was binding on the successors and assigns. And I think that's one anomalous but an important fact in this record.
Well, what happens when Time Warner merges with AOL or whatever, and they've got employment contracts, at least with upper management? Aren't those let's assume that Time Warner emerges as the primary company, and AOL is just swept into it, whatever. Isn't Time Warner still responsible for those contracts that AOL had with their upper management?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think that would be subject to the negotiations between the parties at the time of the deal to merge the two entities.
Okay, so you didn't look up any law in that area?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
In my brief, Your Honor, I did point out case.
I'll tell you what the problem that I have with your case is that there's a contract here. Eventually, PC of Wausau gets swallowed up, even though, you know, I guess you claim that, I guess the documents show that they are the primary person or entity. But in any event, the contract still seems to go on. You've got this name of PC, Production Credit of Wausau, and sure, they've become a lot bigger, but nevertheless, the contract still remains in effect.
I beg to disagree, Your Honor, and
that's why I asked.
Okay, that's why we're here. In 1986, a document was signed by the chief executive officer indicating that upon the merger of Production Credit Association of Wausau and Production Credit Association of North Central Wisconsin, that the surviving entity is Production Credit Association of North Central Wisconsin. Your Honors, when we appeared before the trial court, Judge Mason asked us if this matter was ripe for summary judgment, and I think the record entry number 40 indicates that we more or less stipulated that we're going to decide this issue based upon the record. And Judge Mason decided it.
What issue are you deciding?
Justice Abramson, the issue of whether the plaintiff in this lawsuit, Farm Credit Services of North Central Wisconsin, may enforce a contract to which it was not a party. Our position is that on July 1 of 1991, at the latest, PCA of Wausau was kaput. They canceled their charter, and on the very same day, July 1 of 1991, a brand spanking new charter of the plaintiff Farm Credit Services of North Central Wisconsin was entered. Get back to earlier questions as to whether this matter is ripe for summary judgment. I think that the state courts have adopted a summary judgment rule of quite some long standing that I refer to as a phony baloney summary judgment affidavit rule, and that is once litigation is pending, you don't get around the summary judgment by filing an affidavit to the contrary of prior affidavits that have been filed. Now, true, the two affidavits of merger that Mr. Slater chooses to ignore were pre-litigation, but they were signed by the chief executive officers of his client's predecessor. And I think at this stage, after Judge Mason asked whether the issue was ripe for summary judgment, to somehow fashion an issue of fact, I don't think an issue of fact is present. If, as Mr. Slater indicates, the state business corporation statute dealing with the effect of merger applies, and I believe he conceded that, and if the documents clearly show that there has been a merger and that PCF Wausau is not the surviving corporation, I respectfully submit that that corporation is gone. Now, where that leaves us in the anomalous situation where you have a contract that does not provide its binding on successors and assigns, I think the answer is that under our case law that the contract may not be enforced because there's no one, PCA of Wausau is not present to enforce that contract.
Mr. Dreyer, I'm unclear as to what you agreed to in front of Judge Mason. Was the agreement that even if there are genuine issues of material fact, he should go ahead and decide the matter? Or what did you stipulate to?
I think, Your Honor, it did not reach that point, and perhaps Mr. Slater can address it. My recollection is that Judge Mason asked us, is this matter, that is, whether the plaintiff may enforce the restrictive covenant, is this right for decision by me at this time under the summary judgment record? And my recollection is that Mr. Slater and I agreed, yes, it is.
Well, your position, as I understand it now, is that PCA of Wausau is not a corporation that has survived. And is his position not the opposite of yours?
I don't know, Your Honor. And the reason I said I don't know is I think the position of the plaintiff in this lawsuit is that it still exists by virtue of the what I refer to as the corporate machinations in 1986 and 1991, that he is the successor. But that gets me back to the contractual argument, and I think reduced to its nub, this is a contract case, and that is that the plaintiff may not enforce this contract because the plaintiff was neither a party to it, nor did my client, Mr. Wasaki, agree that any successor could bind him to the restrictive covenant.
Wasn't the contract assumed by the merger? Isn't it the law of mergers and acquisitions that they effectively accomplish an assumption of all assets, liabilities, and contracts of the previous corporation, or the corporation that's going to be ceasing to exist?
I think
depending upon what the terms of the merger document say. I mean, if they specifically exclude some contracts, then that ends the inquiry. But isn't it the general rule, and I think the chief alluded to this at the beginning, isn't it the general rule that assets, liabilities, all contracts of merging corporations are assumed by the successor corporation?
I think that's correct. And before the trial court, I believe I referred the trial court to the federal statute dealing with the effect of mergers and some of the merger documents that refer to, for instance, choses in action. But I think it's fair and it's correct to parcel out this personal service contract because my client never agreed to the merger, and the document that he signed back in 1983 never said that he would agree to have someone else.
There's no rule of law that says an employee, a specific employee, has to agree to a merger.
I agree, Justice Sykes, but the name of the case escapes me, but I cited in my brief a case for the proposition that personal service contracts are not assignable without the consent of the contracting party. And I think that's currently the law in this state.
Counsel, this may be a common sense or just a question I want to ask. In 1983, maybe you said 73, but 83 is when this document was signed, as I understand.
Yes, sir.
And then your client continued to work for PCA or Farm Credit Services for another roughly, 10, 12 years? I mean, I'm just looking at the facts here. So and this goes to what Justice Sykes is asking about, it just didn't seem rational, and you could question that you would expect each employee of those merged corporations to, I'm sure there were other service contracts, to consent to that merger. And you're saying, well, there is a case you cited, there wasn't a case. There isn't a case. Is there a case on this that you could cite to? That's what I want to know.
Whether a personal service contract is assignable without consent?
Right. If it's there, I just wanted to know.
Your Honor, I think it's Tolgren versus School District at 6 West 2nd, 481.
I think that is good case law, that you can't assign. I mean, I think it's the old common law. You can't make somebody, I agree to work for you, you can't then just shove my personal services on to somebody else.
But pick up on this, because the issue is, but then your client continued to work in that capacity. Maybe someone else signed his paycheck, but he went from one corporation to another. There was a smooth or not so smooth transition, but he worked for a substantial period of time.
That's correct, Your Honor. He worked from 86 after the first merger until 1999, and he worked from 91 when the corporate charter was canceled until 1999. I think it's reasonable for employers, however, to just move over to a policy position. I think this court in Tatke decided that employers may revisit covenants not to compete, and it's fair and it's good business practice when you have a major event such as having a new business entity to ask at least your key people to sign restrictive covenants. In my brief, I mentioned three cases from outside of Wisconsin dealing with whether restrictive covenants in a situation like this are enforceable, that is, where there's been essentially a dissolution of the initial employer and a provision that the restrictive covenant is not assignable. That's the Smith case out of Vermont. In that case, I think really hits the nail on the head. The site is 183 Atlantic 2nd 528. And I would invite your honors to take a look at this case. I think it addresses the specific issue of whether restrictive covenant is enforceable by a new employer where there's not consent to the assignment. The second anomalous fact in this case is the identity of the plaintiff, if you will. The Farm Credit Service entities, and I know some of you justices are familiar with the litigation in the 70s and 80s involving these entities. They are a creature of the Great Depression. PCA of Wausau was chartered early in 1934. And I think the rationale behind the federal law is that we want to have local farmers decide what kind of loans we make to other local farmers. Turf is key, geography is key, and local control is key. And I think that it is important in analyzing this case to look at the kind of plaintiff we have. The plaintiff is geographically bound. It could not extend a loan in a neighboring county without the approval of the Farm Credit Administration. It cannot merge without the approval of an adjoining Farm Credit Association. Indeed, this plaintiff is a throwback to the early part of the 20th century rather than looking forward to the kind of plaintiff that typically this court will see in which forms members of the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. We have very few corporations that are geographically bound, and I think it's important in looking at this case to realize that the law in place at the time is in fact embedded in the contract. And I think in fairness to the Court of Appeals at paragraph 14 of its decision, it drew a distinction between chuck wagon when it said, stated another way, and I'm quoting, "The prohibited customer list in chuck wagon did define a geographic territory as well as those customers within it because it covered only those businesses on Radugi's route. It did not cover persons in areas different from the route that Radugi rented from chuck wagon when the lease was signed." I think the Court of Appeals, by inference in this paragraph, was pointing out that this case indeed is distinguishable from chuck wagon because in this case, the employer unilaterally more than doubled the geographical territory. And if you combine that with the strict federal requirements that these corporations, unlike most Wisconsin business corporations, must heed the geographical restrictions, I think that provides more than sufficient rationale for the ultimate decision of the Court of Appeals. As to the, to get back to the contract, the contract signed by my client provides that it is not subject to amendment without his written consent.
Counsel, I was just looking at that provision. Does that provision preclude the argument that there is a consent to assignment? Let me rephrase the question. I'm thinking, okay, after the agreement was signed in 1983, your client continued to work in the same capacity for 12 years, is it?
Well, actually, and this is part of the record, but it's not part of my brief, his job changed after he signed the agreement. The record shows that as late as 1985, he was a loan officer, and he became a tax preparer only after that. But that is a factually intensive inquiry that frankly was not argued at summary judgment before the trial court.
He continued sitting at that desk regardless of the scope of his activities, and whatever the entity was continued giving him a paycheck. Can a consent to assignment be inferred? I ask that question, and then I wonder, picking up the very provision that you're starting to address now, does the provision requiring written modifications at all impact upon the question of whether or not there can be a consent to assignment? Is there a question of fact that there's a consent to assignment?
I don't think there's a question of fact presented in this record as to consent to assignment, particularly in view of what I think the record shows is the fact that PCF Wausau was merged out of existence in 1986, and if it still had some ebb and flow of life, it was gone in 1991 when a brand spanking new charter replaced the charter that was canceled by the Farm Credit Administration. So although he worked at the same desk, did the same work, he was working for a new employer. And that employer did not come into existence until 8 years after he signed the contract. I think that employer is a stranger to the contract.
Did the employer hire him then?
He showed up, he got a paycheck. But
I know that. I mean, that's clear. That's why I talk about the consent, you know. But was there anything in the record that suggests that each of these new entities said, hey, we want to hire you? Or was there a consent to a continuation of the relationship?
As to employer-employee, he continued to show up. I mean, that's shown in the record. As to whether he signed a new contract containing what this court has repeatedly said must be looked at with disfavor. We don't hug these contracts. We hold them at arm's length and look at them with a jaundiced eye because they're in restraint of trade. I think that particularly in view of the non-merger clause in the contract, that under this record, there's no factual issue as to whether he consented to having a new restrictive covenant because he would have had to sign a new restrictive covenant. He never did so. He was never asked to do so. And I think it's fair to fault Farm Credit Services for throughout these 16 years never coming up to him and saying, we're a new corporation, sign a new non-compete. They never did so.
Justice Prosser has a question.
I think the first question is, does consent have to be in writing?
Justice Prosser, the contract says that no amendment to this contract shall be valid unless it is writing and executed by the parties, and no evidence of such amendment shall be received in any proceeding unless the amendment is in writing and executed as described. That's paragraph 6 of the contract. That's one of the stronger non-merger clauses I've seen, and there's nothing in the record to support.
What was his status at that point? Was he an employee at will?
Yes, Your Honor, I think he was.
Doesn't a service contract often have conditions very beneficial to the employee? I mean, let's suppose stock options or something like that. Are you saying that the moment there's a merger, unless there's a new written agreement, all the provisions of a previous personal service agreement that benefit the employee are gone? Is that right?
I think that's the logical result of what I'm saying. I'm not prepared to address whether that's good policy. I think the current law of this state is that in a personal service contract that if you have a new party coming in, that it's a good idea to have the employees sign new contracts.
What if an employer wants to get rid of a lot of employees, has a lot of middle management, you know, wants to downsize, and you've got all these difficult employment contracts from the employer's point of view, and boy, I don't want to have to pay all those benefits and this future stock options. And why doesn't the employer just change their name? And then that contract that was signed between the employee and XYZ Corporation, now that corporation, everyone's sitting at the same desk and everyone's in the same building, the only difference is that XYZ became ABC and says, sorry, we don't have to honor any of that stuff.
Well, if it's simply a name change, I think the law that we've been talking about would not apply, but if there was a bona fide merger, if there is a personal service contract, I know I'm not answering the policy argument. I think the current law of this state, and I think the law applicable to my client back in 1999 was that the new employer may not enforce that contract.
I suggest that the reason the contract doesn't say successors and assigns is because of a law you quote that personal service contracts are not assignable. And I agree with that. But to follow up on Justice Bradley's question, your response is if you just change your name, it's really the same entity.
Yeah, full finance system. I'm sorry.
You may have only two shareholders, right, in a corporation. And suppose those two shareholders sell out to another two shareholders. They come in, name of the company is the same, upper management has changed drastically. Your client's contract is still good with that corporation, even though it has changed significantly. Isn't that right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I knew that you would say that. Because I'm going to lead you down that path, because I'm going to get from the shareholders. I mean, Justice Bradley started you out on the names. Then I'm going to get to you where the shareholders change, but the entity and the contract is with the entity is the same, but it's really very much different as a practical matter, which and then will ultimately get you down to a merger, if this is a real merger, because I don't think that a merger is really any different than the situation I gave you about the shareholders, because your entity, it's a continuing and evolving entity, but it's essentially, for purposes of law, the two are still in existence, but they're now in one, or the three are in existence and they're now in one. And as a practical matter, when you look at that entity, it's difficult for me to think that you've got to renegotiate every single contract, whether it be for personal services of one person or a labor union contract, unless there's something in that contract that says, I'm only staying here if John Smith owns 51% of the stock, or you don't merge with ABC. And I think that's one of the difficulties. Now, your position is it's not a real merger.
So excuse me?
If I understand your position, it's not a real merger. It doesn't come into being a merger that company is out of existence that he made the contract with and it's gone.
Well, to begin with, there's a merger, and then there's a, in 1986, and in 1991, there's a cancellation of the charter by the Farm Credit Administration, and a new charter that did not reference the old.
So you're saying it just started again.
I use the term brand spanking new, and I don't have an answer to the policy argument. You know, and the overall global question is what happens to personal service contracts if there's a merger? I do know that the merger statute says the old corporation is kaput. It's gone.
Let's just go to the restrictive covenant with just a few more minutes left. What's the matter with this restrictive covenant? Was it good at the beginning when it said you don't reach any of my any of the people you work with for the last year?
Yes.
Laid out in general. There's nothing the matter with that contract.
No.
It's very limited in time, one
yes.
year. And it's very limited. It doesn't say all customers of the corporation. It's very limited, only the ones you had contact with. So that was good. Now, let's say there was no merger, and the company just naturally expands. Starts out in Dane County, and it expands to all of the southeast counties. Expands all over the state.
many more customers, and the employee deals with many more customers. What would your position be, leaving out the merger issue?
In the mine run situation, that would happen, and my client and I would have no objection to it. I would respectfully submit that that is an impossible hypothetical for this particular plaintiff, this plaintiff that is bound by the territory, by its charter. And that's why, in my briefs, I tried to show that this was indeed a really unusual situation, because the plaintiff literally could not do that without violating the terms of its charter and federal law.
At the time of it. But there are other franchises, and they have limited geographical area. You can run X number of McDonald's in such and such a territory, and then later on, this franchise holder gets permission or buys a bigger territory, and then ultimately buys umpteen other territories. So you have car dealers who start off as Buicks, and then they wind up with 20 other autos that they can sell. And you have employees that have restrictive covenants. So it's not unusual to expand business way beyond what was originally contemplated or even allowed. Would you say that in all of those cases I gave you, that the deal is off as to the restrictive covenant?
No, to take them in order, I think if you have a true franchise situation where the franchisee is geographically limited, let's say to Dane County,
right,
and I'm running that business, and I have a couple key employees that really are the wheels in the business, and I want them around, and I want them for me, I don't want them for anyone else. I think if I expand, rather than saying gotcha and ending up in court, I think it's a good idea to sit down with those two individuals.
It may be a good idea, but the question is, does the law say I gotcha?
Well, absent a charter restriction?
Well, it's like a charter restriction. I mean, I'm just trying to give it you the charter restriction in a different sense.
I understand. If the geographical restriction is a contract between the franchisor and the franchisee, and it is expanded, let's say to another county, without the knowledge of the employee, if it's doubled, if the franchise breaks into a whole new area that was not part of the original franchise, I think there's a really significant question as to the enforceability of the restrictive covenant between a franchisee and those two key people.
Why?
Well,
let's say the restrictive covenant doesn't have any geographic restrictions that, as yours did not. Yours was a customer-based restrictive covenant only, and only those that your client serviced, and only those your client serviced within the preceding year of the termination. So it was very narrowly drawn to comply with the law. And let's say that just in the ordinary course of the expansion of the business, the sort of group of customers got a lot bigger than everybody anticipated, so that when your client wanted to leave and start up his own business, there were a lot more then than there were at the beginning. Does that invalidate the restrictive covenant?
I don't think that scenario would, and I'd like to go back to this specific plaintiff. As it impacts my client, he had no choice in the additional six counties. If a customer, he was an employee, not an employer, if his boss said, you prepare Joe's tax return from this new county, he would have no choice but to do it. That was not part of the initial bargain that he made.
Well, he wasn't complaining about it, was he? I mean, he... that was, I'm sorry, not an appropriate way to ask the question. I mean, he went along with it. This goes to his implied consent to what was going on. He knew that these murders were taking place. He knew that this geographically expanded the reach of the company that he had contracted with, and therefore would geographically, by definition, expand the reach of the restrictive covenant should he choose to split off and start his own company in competition with his former employee. And he impliedly assented to all of that by his staying on, didn't he?
I don't think so. This is not in the record, but I can represent to the justices that many of these corporate things he was not even aware of. And what the effect of this was that if he decided that he wanted to set up shop in these new six counties or so, he was disabled from doing so, and he never agreed to that.
Well, let me ask you, he was disabled from doing so only with people that he had dealt with for a period of 1 year.
That's correct.
Have I correctly stated it?
That's correct.
Well, thank you, counsel.
Well, thank you. It's been real. I have one agricultural joke, if I see the red lights on.
There's always time for a joke.
How many lawyers does it take to grease a combine?
Oh, I'm sorry that we asked.
What if you put them through slowly?
That would not appear in the opinion.
It might be in the footnote.
The next time the red light means red light. What's going to pass the motion that I should not allow any jokes? Mr. Slater.
Thank you. A couple of high points. First of all, Mr. Dreyer wants to incorporate and impose upon this contract between these parties one narrow provision, which is the six county provision. But if you're going to do that, then you've got to do the whole panoply. And the fact of the matter is that the Farm Credit Act permits mergers, which contemplate enlargements. It permits the change of territories. So if you're going to incorporate one, you have to incorporate that. And it actually permits associations to trade off territories. So that if you have a center with six territories and another one over here with six territories, and because of the geography of where the head office is located or how customers fall, you can't apply to have your territory changed. So if part of the contract of the parties was the five counties, then these other provisions which are provided in the Farm Credit Act also have to be in there. Mr. Dreyer keeps saying it's a new corporation. I think you have to go back, and I would ask that the justices do this, go back and read as part of the record the merger documents. And the merger documents say without equivocation that the surviving corporation shall be. And it's the same corporation that was established in 1934. The fact that the Farm Credit Administration may have issued a new piece of paper called a charter with different names on it, the names of the different directors, should not matter. You've got to go back and see what the actual merger documents are and what those actually do. And those merger documents are and do say the surviving corporation. And when Mr. Dreyer makes the representation that the statute, a merger statute, says that the old corporation is kaput, that it's done, that's not true. It says every corporation except the survivor corporation or the new corporation, referring first to mergers or the surviving corporation or the new corporation, referring to consolidation, because the statute addresses both mergers and consolidations in the same statute.
So this whole issue of the assumption of this personal services contract is a red herring?
We believe so. Absolutely so. It's the same corporation, we believe so.
Mr. Slater,
yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what remedy do you want here? I mean, are you seeking damages for taking away your business? Time has passed. Isn't he free of the restrictive covenant?
Time has passed, but there are two answers to that. First of all, our complaint and the contract provide, the contract provides for liquidated damages. This court has ruled that that does not bar one from seeking an injunction. Those two things are separate, so we would seek damages if that's appropriate. But it also is a policy matter. You can't, in my opinion, say, okay, I'm an employee, I've got this covenant, if I litigate it long enough, I'm going to get out from under it, and I'll work with the damages. So an injunction, even as today, may be an appropriate remedy. It's up to the trial court, I think.
Well, what would you enjoin?
I guess the trial court would enjoin him for a one-year period of time, commencing at the time of the conclusion, from doing those particular people who he did. In the alternative, he would say, this is not an adequate or a real remedy, and therefore we will revert to either actual damages, or there's a $250 per violation of liquidated damages in the contract.
250, so that would be 250 times each?
Times each tax return, which he prepared.
For that one year?
Yes, because we're dealing with a tax season type thing, the activity pretty much occurs once a year.
Oh, they send in estimated tax returns. That would be three times, four times a year. They may have to amend the return. You're going to ask for liquidated damages on all of that. Something else. The whole argument about liquidated damages and whether they're a penalty or liquidated damages, that's not...
No, we've never argued that point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our hearing on 99-1013, Farm Credit Services of North Central Wisconsin versus David Boisaki. Thank you, counsel. Thank you.